From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas, sitting in for John Horn. Though we will be hearing from John, he's on his way to the Telluride Film Festival, which launches Hollywood award season. Also on today's show, the prolific and celebrated British singer-songwriter Richard Thompson has a new album. He shares some of what he's learned in his 50 years of music making.
It's the communication that I think is the big payoff, this idea that something inside you can actually reach other people. As Yo-Yo Ma said, make the music live in other people's hearts.
And what would happen if you tried to watch TV the old-fashioned way? No cable, no satellite, no streaming. All that coming up on The Frame. John's en route to the Telluride Film Festival, which is the unofficial launch to award season for the movie industry. The festival's official lineup was just announced today. Some notable films unveiled at Telluride in past years, like Spotlight, The Shape of Water, and Moonlight, went on to win Best Picture at the Oscars. I caught up with John on his way to the event during a layover in Denver and started our conversation with a question about what sets Telluride apart from other film festivals.
You think of the Cannes Film Festival, it's like big red carpets, fancy yachts. Sundance is all about American independent film. The Toronto International Film Festival has a lot more studio films. Telluride is much more eclectic. It shows documentaries, foreign language films. It has a lot of feature films, but they're not just from the States. There's some international titles. And it all unfolds over 3 days. So it all happens pretty quickly and very concentrated.
The schedule is just out today. So what's standing out for you?
One is a movie called First Man. It's directed by Damien Chazelle, who made La La Land. It's about Neil Armstrong in a period just before the lunar landing. He's played by Ryan Gosling in the film. Jason Reitman, who has been at the festival before with Up in the Air, has a film called The Front Runner. It's about Senator Gary Hart's run for president and the Donna Rice scandal. Hugh Jackman plays Gary Hart. Alfonso Cuarón, who is another Telluride alumnus, he had Gravity here a couple years ago, has made a very personal story based on his own life. It's Spanish language and black and white. It's called Roma. And then the movie has probably taken the longest path to get here is an Orson Welles movie, which he never finished in his lifetime. He started shooting it decades ago. It's called The Other Side of the Wind. They finally put it all together. And there's also a documentary about the film itself by Morgan Neville called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead.
So a lot of film festivals, including Cannes and Venice, Italy, have been criticized for not screening many films by female directors. So how's Telluride doing this year on that front?
I would say about as badly as others. And there's a couple factors that I think we should consider. One is, you know, a lot of people who are handing out directing jobs aren't hiring a lot of women. But that's where festivals can really step up and try to kind of turn the tables a little bit. Last year, Telluride had Lady Bird by Greta Gerwig. They had an Angelina Jolie movie called First They Kill My Father. Battle of the Sexes, the Billie Jean King movie, was co-directed by a woman. And The Rider, a movie directed by Chloe Zhao, and there's some documentaries that were either made or co-made by female filmmakers. This year, not any improvement. There's a narrative feature by Marielle Heller called Can You Ever Forgive Me? And then there is a film directed by Karan Kusama. It's called Destroyer. It stars Nicole Kidman. And then there's a foreign language film called Birds of Passage that was co-directed by a woman that played at the Cannes Festival. If you look in documentaries, there's some documentaries that are either made by or co-made by female filmmakers. But in terms of other festivals, Telluride is about as bad as some of the others right now.
There's also been some criticism that female film critics are not well represented at some festivals. Sundance in Toronto, festival organizers are saving at least 20% of their top-tier press credentials for women and minority writers. Is Telluride doing anything like that?
Telluride has a small program called the Film Scholar Program that it does in conjunction with the University of Wisconsin. And it's intended to try to kind of grow the next generation of movie critics. And Julie Hunsinger, who runs the Telluride Festival, says that this year, half of those aspiring film critics will be women. The real problem with Telluride, it's not just people of color, it's not just women, it's like people of means. It takes a lot of time and money to get here. press people have to pay for their own credentials. There's no free passes like there are at other festivals. So it's not just, you know, underrepresented critics who have a hard time coming here. It's people who don't work for huge outlets that can afford the expense of getting to Telluride and then buying a pass to cover it.
There's a fairly notable absence at this year's festival. Barry Jenkins, the writer-director of the 2017 Best Picture Oscar, Moonlight, will not be at Telluride this year, even though he's been kind of a staple there, going back to even when he was a volunteer. His new film, If Beale Street Could Talk, based on the novel by James Baldwin, will instead premiere in Toronto. Why is he not screening there at Telluride?
Well, the festival wouldn't say. I suspect it has to be a decision based on the merits of the film, but there is no filmmaker that I can think of currently who has closer ties to Telluride than Barry Jenkins. Not only did Moonlight premiere at the festival, but also he's worked in theaters there. I really am looking forward to this film. Of all the movies that I was really expecting to be at Telluride, If Beale Street Could Talk had to be on the top of the list.
Well, what's the early buzz on that film?
The buzz is good. I mean, but if Telluride passed on it, the buzz maybe is questionable. I mean, Telluride, even though it programs a really eclectic slate of films, when it comes to picking movies that are going to do well at the Academy Awards, their track record is unbelievable. I mean, King's Speech, Argo, 12 Years a Slave, Birdman, Spotlight, Barry's movie Moonlight, The Shape of Water, all of those movies had either their North American or world premieres at Telluride. So the fact that Beale Street isn't in, it's weird, but I guess when we see it, we'll see if Telluride made the right choice or the wrong choice.
That's The Frame's John Horn. He's in Telluride this weekend covering the Telluride Film Festival. John, enjoy. Thanks so much.
Thanks for filling in.
Coming up on The Frame, Richard Thompson isn't known as a political songwriter, but he is a Muslim immigrant living in the U.S., so he does have a few things on his mind. Years ago, the folk rock band Fairport Convention set out to reinvigorate the English folk tradition. Guitarist and founding member Richard Thompson has stayed true to those roots, creating a vast body of work as a solo artist that's left a lasting mark on the wider world of popular music. Throughout his career, he's collaborated with the likes of Nick Drake, David Byrne, and Wilco's Jeff Tweedy, and been covered by everyone from Bonnie Raitt to Sleater-Kinney. His most recent album, 13 Rivers, recorded in a live setting here in Los Angeles, showcases his witty and often dark songwriting, as well as his meticulous guitar work. But when I spoke with him this morning, we started with a track from his 2003 live album, 1,000 Years of Popular Music, an exploration of music that spans from medieval songs to Britney Spears. This is his take on a 13th century song called Summer Is a Comin' In.
Summer is a comin' in, though the things will come, though a seed and blow at me, then spring the world in you. Sing a chorus, you will put a bust along the front.
Richard, can you tell me about that song and how you found it?
Oh, that's a fairly well-known song. I think it dates from the 1300s. And it's the earliest known round in the English language. Yeah, the idea of a round is that someone starts and then someone else starts a bar or two later and then someone else starts a bar or two after that. It's a fascinating piece of music. And I think they found it in the collection of the Bishop of Winchester, who was a bit of a raver, the Bishop of Winchester at the time.
How so?
I think he was up before the Archbishop like twice for having, you know, dalliances with nuns. So he was a bit of a man of the world, as well as being a man of the cloth.
What did you learn about songwriting as you searched for and found and decided which songs you would interpret for 1,000 Years of Popular Music?
I think the main thing is that, you know, you find out that the dance music's dance music, and it's always been pretty much the same. You know, Tamla Motown isn't that far away from, you know, Italian dance music of the 1600s. You know, a love song is a love song, and political song is a political song. And there's been lots of those in the last 1,000 years.
Well, you are not overtly political in your songwriting, though you have at times reflected on war, politics, faith. A song on your last album still even includes a skewering of, I guess, what you could call a fictionalized real estate baron turned politician named Fergus Lang, who builds and builds, yet small is his erection, and he has a fine head of hair when the wind's in the right direction.
Who could that be? I don't know.
I don't know. I'm scratching my head over it. You converted to Islam in the 1970s as a Sufi. You also lived a good part of the last 30 years in the U.S. So you're a Muslim and you're an immigrant in the U.S. in the Trump era. How's the last couple of years been for you living here in the U.S.? And has it made you, you know, reconsider at all your decision to live here?
Well, it's gotten stranger for sure. You know, that there's a lot of hate out there, you know, hate of minority groups, hate of immigrants, hate of something that isn't basically old and white, I suppose, is the expression I would use. So, you know, that's something that you reflect on. You know, on the other hand, you know, in a Western country like the United States or like the UK, you know, you have a lot more freedom of religious expression than you do in almost any country in the Middle East, for instance. So, I'm happy to be a Westerner. I'm happy to live in the West. But a few small turns of the screw here and there in America, and it will become a very dangerous country, a very authoritarian country. But I hope Americans are going to be sensible about their voting choices coming up.
And how is all of this, you know, these, I guess what you would call external pressures that many people are feeling, including yourself in different ways, how does that, if at all, affect your creative process?
Well, it does affect the creative process, and you can certainly write songs about that. You can write songs about the state of society. You can write songs about, you know, your own relationships or what you see around you of your friends and family. And sometimes you can write a political song disguised as a personal song, and sometimes you can write the opposite. You can write a personal song disguised as a political song. So, you know, it's all inspirational, you know, in some way. I think, you know, all that is grist to the mill, and it goes into the, you know, the big hopper, and it gets crunched around, and sometimes, you know, creative things come out.
So how easily or not do songs come for you, lyrically especially?
Well, I think some songs come easily lyrically. Some songs start lyrics first, and some songs start melody first, and you kind of work, you know, towards a completion one way or the other. I think if it wasn't difficult sometimes, then you wouldn't feel the reward of it when it does work. So I think there is a lot of staring out the window. There's a lot of beating your head against the wall. I think the important thing in writing is to not get stuck, if you can possibly help it, is to keep flowing. And sometimes at the beginning, if you can say, I've got this song that never got finished, and I'd love to add a verse to it. And sometimes that's easier than starting with a completely blank page.
Right.
And, you know, as you're finishing off that other song, then other ideas come to you, and you're not really conscious of the beginning process. It just kind of flows in. It's almost like your subconscious takes over.
Yeah.
I think on this new record, a lot of the songs seem to be not something I set out to write deliberately, but just songs that arrived.
Really? So that's unlike the way songs have come to you in the past?
It's been more of a mixture in the past. In the past, I've said, okay, there's a song, you know, I want to write a song in this tempo, you know, or I want to write a song to show off, you know, guitar playing in the key of F, you know. yeah. You know, like mundane ideas that actually lead to creativity, and it doesn't really matter how you start.
Yeah,
it's, you know, it's where you arrive. It's important. So, you know, on this record, it really was very much a kind of like a semi-conscious, unconscious process. That once I was in the right mind frame, that then stuff would just kind of turn up, and I'm very grateful it did.
That's nice. I'm sure. I want to ask you about a song from 13 Rivers. It's this very haunting ballad, more like a dirge, really, I guess, called The Dog in You. Let's hear a little bit, and then I can ask you about it.
It's not love that you're looking for,
And it's not love that you're hunting down. You're just on the trail of the innocent, the frail, and you're gonna rob them.
And that's Richard Thompson from his forthcoming album, 13 Rivers. There's lots of things I really like about that song, but one of the things that really stood out to me was the way you sing it. Mm. Can you tell me about, you know, composing this song and about your vocal technique?
For me, this is kind of a harrowing subject. This is about like a sexual predator, and it happened to someone I know, and so it affected me very deeply. I suppose you call it like a blues, but it's really it's a Scottish slow march to me. You know, it's got that real kind of almost like a Scottish funeral march feel to it. Vocally, I mean, this is a live vocal. This is just what happened. You know, this was first take, and I just thought, well that's it. I mean, I can't do it again. Vocal technique. I think vocal technique just comes from doing it more than anything else. I've listened to a lot of traditional singers and traditional folk singers in Britain, and I've always admired some of the vocal inflections and ornaments that they use. So I probably lean in that direction rather than, you know, listening to pop singers. It's also a problem for people sometimes to sing in your own voice. So many English singers put on an American accent, which I find slightly ludicrous. So I really try to just sing the same as I talk, really, if I can.
Given the difficult subject matter of that song and the pain, is that something you'll be performing live, or is it a song that maybe is a bit too difficult to perform every night?
Yeah, it's a tough one. It really is a tough one. And there are some songs that I try to, I wouldn't say I'd never perform them, but I try to avoid performing them, and that might be an avoider.
Interesting. Wow. Mm. You continue to play dozens of concerts every year, and you'll be starting a big tour in the fall. Mm. So after some 50 years of live performing, is it still rewarding?
It's the big reward, I think. You know, writing songs is great. You know, recording is great. But to perform, you know, in front of an audience is the greatest. I mean, that's the biggest thrill, especially if they like it. You think, oh, fantastic. Something communicated. It's the communication that I think is the big payoff, this idea that something inside you can actually reach other people. As Yo-Yo Ma said, make the music live in other people's hearts. And I think that's wise words to live by.
Yeah. Well, let's close with something from 13 Rivers. This is My Rock, My Rope. It has this wonderful hymn-like quality, almost like a prayer. Anything you want to say about it before we hear it?
You know, I've found at various points in my life that I just need help. You know, I need help from other people. I need like spiritual help. And you can take this song either way. It's either a kind of a call to other human beings to bail you out, or it's a call to a higher being to bail you out. So it, as you say, it has a hymn-like quality. I mean, it's a kind of a hymn.
Richard Thompson, his new album, 13 Rivers, is out September 14th. Richard Thompson, thank you so much.
Thank you, my pleasure.
In my pain, in my dark.
Up next on The Frame, what would happen if you tried to watch TV the old-fashioned way? No cable, no satellite, no streaming. We'll take you back to another time.
In my sorrow is my rock, is my rope. Oh, give me the strength to bear it. Oh, give me the strength to see. This is not forever, but what must be, must be.
And now, in this era of so-called peak TV, the menu of stuff to watch on the small screen is seemingly endless. And that got us thinking what it would be like to watch TV the old-fashioned way. No cable, no satellite, no streaming. We asked The Frame contributor Colin Friesen to take on the assignment, and as you'll hear, he's watched way too many Ken Burns documentaries. Here's his letter home from the low-tech battlefront.
My dearest wife, I'm emailing you from our two-bedroom, rent-controlled Silver Lake home to advise that I now understand your need to take leave whilst I attempt this TV viewing folly. A week with no cable, no streaming, or over-the-top services. I pray God forgive me my hubris. My first goal, of course, was to procure a set still possessing enough clarity and overall worthfulness that it might lend its pixels to my endeavor. Thankfully, a friend had not cleaned his garage in many a fortnight and was able to acquaint me to his Sharp TV combination VCR player, but for the simple promise of never returning said appliance back to his domicile. As expected, a test run in the kitchen showed us naught but snow.
Snow.
It's a slightly different shade of snow.
Snow, there's dark snow. Yeah, well, it's pretty consistent through all the channels.
Was I to spend the next few days in absence of programs like The Bachelorette, The Males Do Affirm, or the new season of Orange Beeth the New Pitch? I am reminded that in the year 2009, the federal government opined and lawed into fashion a decree that there would be no more readily available signals over the air without aid of a box capable of digital transubstantiation.
If your TV isn't hooked up to a cable or satellite receiver, you'll need to get a converter box.
Clearly, a sojourn to the local merchants at the Best of Buys was in order, and I soon found myself in possession of an archaic device known as a VHF-UHF antenna that, even before the remainder of my purchases were attached, filled me with hope.
Bueno, por ejemplo, la gente que dice, ay,
my best guess was the picture, only a rough outline of a woman, came from south of the border where the old ways still hold sway. My courage and curiosity piqued, I quickly attached the so-called analog-to-digital converter box and reclined, as is my wont, and hit the button marked power.
George. Well, you got the snowboard, so how about new ski clothes to wear on your winter getaway to Sun Valley, Idaho?
The program was familiar and the picture as sharp as a Quaker's scythe, but as I started to navigate the rank of channels, I realized any previous notion of my viewing habits would soon evaporate like the morning dew. The Los Angeles cultural mosaic was on fine display. But if one were to judge this city based primarily on its antenna TV content, you might assume it populated mostly by Korean speakers in need of legal representation or Japanese-sourced dietary supplements.
The face mask xin giới thiệu nghệ lên men dạng viên sản xuất tại Nhật Bản, giúp tiêu hóa tốt, giảm ở chua, đau bao tử.
I discovered a preponderance of home shopping options, but also stations seemingly designed to appeal to the older members of our community. Some of which, to my consternation, brought forth programs featuring all manner of currently socially dubious thought.
Is marrying Indian women the accepted thing out there?
Well, yes, ma'am, there isn't enough white women to go around.
Which is not to discount the religious component. The antennaed world showed me a multi-channel battle for the souls of this strange new land. I stumbled upon such a program demonstrating Christ's love that pictured an animated Jesus literally dragging a naked sinner by the ankle and tossing him into a pit of maggots that also, by luck or happenstance, were on fire. I would mention for modesty's sake the unclothed transgressor was turned away from our view to lessen any genital forwardness.
Jesus, Jesus, tú eres el Señor!
I moved on. The channel started to swim before my eyes. While the picture quality was pleasing, there was often a delay of the sound, giving the speakers the dubbed quality normally associated with a spaghetti western. There were many vintage programs, but my thirst for anything reminiscent of peak TV seemed doomed to remain unquenched. And yet I persisted, moving through the channels in the 40s, into the 50s, and then the 60s, where PBS had forged a battlefront. I was losing all hope when the most miraculous thing occurred.
Yes! Which school and what are you studying?
I'm going to UC Riverside and I'll be studying business marketing.
I was back in familiar land with CBS and Let's Make a Deal. Yes, like a greenhorn lost in the woods, I had moved in a full circle. My dear wife, I understand why you had to abandon me during this ill-advised tryst with bygone technology. I am told that a better antenna might improve my viewing prospects, but longing for your company dampens any thought I have of trying again. Return to me, my darling, and I promise a world of overpriced cable television, along with a few supplements that did appear to do wonders for the spasms triggered by the ill humors illustrated in the animated colon. With fondest regards, for you, I remain ever thusly, Colin Friesen.
And that's our show for today. Join us tomorrow when we'll have coverage of Aretha Franklin's funeral. The program includes Chaka Khan, Ronald Isley, Smokey Robinson, Jennifer Hudson, and Stevie Wonder, among others. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.